This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you're enjoying this July 4th. This summer marks the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' groundbreaking album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. As part of the celebration, a 4-CD box set was released collecting archival recordings from the Sgt. Pepper session, including several of the basic vocal tracks before the addition of the orchestra, sound effects, and processing. The box also includes the original mono version of the album. That's the version that was originally released in England. A hastily remixed stereo version is what was originally released in the U.S. A new stereo remix is included in the anniversary box, too. My guest Giles Martin produced that remix and oversaw this entire anniversary project. He's the son of George Martin, who produced the original Sgt. Pepper album. George Martin gave the Beatles their first record contract, produced their first single, and worked with them on all their albums through Abbey Road. From the time Giles was a teenager, he worked with his father in the studio. Giles has worked on several other recent Beatles projects, including the Beatles soundscape for the Cirque du Soleil production Love, the audio restoration of Beatles concerts for Ron Howard's documentary 8 Days a Week, and the Beatles Rock Band video game. Giles was the executive producer of Paul McCartney's 2013 album New. Last month, Giles Martin spoke to me from the Abbey Road Studios. We started with his stereo remix of the title track of Sgt. Pepper from the new anniversary collection. Giles Martin, welcome to Fresh Air. So why did you decide to do this project with the rehearsal takes and the outtakes and the stereo remix and the mono version?
Well, first up, I mean, it's not me that decides. I'm kind of part of the process. But it's really the Beatles, the Ringo and Paul and Yoko Ono and Olivia Harrison that kind of, they run the Beatles. And I work for them. But I'm asked, you know, what can we do here and what can we do with the 50th anniversary release? And with the outtakes, we wanted to really show how human the making of the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was and really open up, you know, open up the engine and see what's inside. And with the remix, we wanted to, you know, really explore what the band's vision was when they mixed it originally and sort of bring it in today's world, I suppose.
It was originally mixed in mono with the Beatles helping to oversee the mix, but it was released in stereo. And apparently the original stereo remix was done very quickly, whereas the original mono mix was incredibly time consuming and meticulous. What happened?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. The band did mix the mono. I mean, the mono, you see, in the UK, especially at that time, mono was the thing. I mean, stereo was kind of a novelty. And the way music was listened to through one speaker. In fact, I'd even go as far as to say as the record was made to be played out of one speaker. So when it came to the mix, and, you know, in today's standards, the album didn't take very long, but then it took an eternity. It took 3 months to do. The band actually were hands-on with the mix. The mix was a performance, and they had their hands on the desk. They were with my father, George Martin, and Jeff Emmerich. And they mixed the album physically. And then when it came to the stereo, the band didn't even turn up. And it was done very quickly. They didn't really put the same effects on. It was more a question of crazy panning. And For that reason, what we did going back to this mix is we kind of listened to what the boys did in the studios with the mono. It's almost like the spirits were with us, and we sort of created a stereo mix out of that.
So when you were remixing Sgt. Pepper's, the title track, did you go back to the original recordings of the crowd sounds and the tuning up sound, or did you just have remix the layers of tracks that were used? Like,
no, we have to be. Well, we have to be. It's a bit like Jurassic Park in a way. You have to find the mosquito inside the amber to make the dinosaur. And we went back. The audience sound at the beginning of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the song, was taken from a recording my father did of a comedy troupe called Beyond the Fringe, who had a comedy troupe consisting of Dudley Moore, Peter Cook, Alan Bennett, and Jonathan Miller, who were up at Cambridge University, and he went up there and recorded them, and that was the audience. So we found that tape, and we actually layered it. It was in stereo, so we could now have stereo audience. Of course, the Beatles would have bounced that down to mono, so it sounds different. And really, the way you should think about this mix is we're going from the freshest possible material. The thing about recording is that the performance never gets old. It's the we get old, and recording is a sort of things are frozen in time. And so everything we took was the earliest generation. And that's a lot to do with why the album sounds like it does now.
So I want to play back-to-back the stereo mix that was released in the U.S. back in 67 and your new stereo remix. And I thought we'd hear Mr. Kite, being for the benefit of Mr. Kite, because I think you can hear how much more like vivid the new remix is. I guess part of that is the technology too. Like you can just
in a strange way it's technology, but it's also we'd actually make things clearer. If you think about the way my father had to record the Beatles, they had a 4-track tape machine, a 1-inch 4-track tape machine. So you could have four things on one tape. But of course, when it came to Sgt. Pepper, the album, they wanted to have loads of different elements, loads of different soundscapes. And so what they would do, they'd do a copy of a copy, or another copy. So if you imagine the days of cassettes where you used to make cassette copies, that cassette copy would sound a little bit duller, a little bit less dynamic. There's no real button that says, make things sound more live or more real. It's, in essence, what we're doing is we're taking away technology by having the first generations of tapes being played. Which they couldn't do when they mixed. They couldn't sync up tape machines in the same way we can now. And so a lot of the reason why people say that they, with this new version of the album, they can hear things is just because that's what's on tape. And so I think, my dream is to make people feel as though they're close to the band in the studios, and they feel, they can, as my dad said with John Lennon, said to him, I want to smell the sawdust. And on this particular track, we wanted to get them closer to smelling the sawdust.
Is there anything that you'd like to say specifically about the stereo version of the song that was originally released in the U.S. and your remix?
Well, what you'll hear is that the way it's recorded, actually, it's recorded live with Ringo playing drums. My dad is playing a harmonium, which is kind of a wheezy organ that you pump with your feet. Paul's playing live bass and John's singing. That's the first 4-track. And then that's sort of in the version that came out in 67, that's then bounced down and bounced down again. So there's 3 copies of it where we're working from that source material. So you'll hear them a lot clearer. And then all of the whirly organ sounds, which are the chopped up tapes, the chopped up calliopes, we have that tape. And so we layer that across and we can swirl that around your head a lot more. So if it's in stereo, you can hear it go left to right. And on the original, it just has to stay in one place. They didn't have the technology. So it's much more immersive. And it's, as you say, it's clearer and you feel close to John.
So let's hear 2 versions of Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, the first version from the original stereo that was released in the States in 1967. The second version is the new 50th anniversary stereo remix. We're going to hear the second part of the song, the latter part of the song, so we get to hear the calliope stuff going on at the end.
Mrs. K and H assure the public their production will be second to none. And of course, Henry the Horse dances the waltz. The celebrated Mr. Mr. K performs his feat on Saturday at Bishopsgate. The Hendersons will dance and sing as Mr. Kite flies through the ring. Don't be late. Mrs. K and H assure the public their production will be second to none. And of course, Henry the Horse dances in the walls.
That was the original 1967 stereo version of For the Benefit of Mr. Kite and the new stereo remix on the new 50th anniversary edition of Sgt. Pepper's, produced by my guest Giles Martin, who's the son of the original producer of Sgt. Pepper's, George Martin. So before we heard that, you alluded to the chopped up tape of Calliope's. So explain the chopping up, because we heard that part.
Well, what happened was is that in the sort of bridge sections, you hear sort of swirling, and a lot of them are chromatic runs, so all the notes played on an octave, slowed down on Hammond organs. There's a guitar part as well, and then the tape sped up, so it's double time. But they still couldn't get the sound of a circus or a fair to match the vision that John Lennon had of the poster. This song stems from a poster that John Lennon found in a store. Which has basically all the lyrics on it of a Victorian circus. And what my father realized they had to do is they had to get that fairground sound. But a calliope is basically a steam organ, an old steam organ that you see in fairgrounds. Now, they don't play what you really want them to play. You can't get to play a part. They sort of put in a punched card, and the organ will play back what's on that punched card. So all they could do was record a number of these organs and then chop them together to create this collage of sound. So there's a swirling collage of calliope organs that creates a sort of sound bed. They always wanted, my father and the Beatles always wanted to hear sounds they'd never heard before. And being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite is an excellent example of that.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Giles Martin, and he is the producer of the new 50th anniversary box set of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
And I just have to say that I'm definitely not the producer of the Beatles. The producer is definitely my father. All
right,
I've
your
done
father
is,
produced, your father George
yeah,
Martin produced the original version.
All I've done is we've remixed the album. And I always feel nervous about, you know, talking about it, because you think, I wasn't even born when this came out, and all I'm trying to do is serve them in a way, if that makes sense.
So I'm one of the things that made this album such a kind of cultural turning point musically is that it was a psychedelic album. I mean, there were things going on in the album that seemed almost designed for people to listen to while smoking marijuana or taking LSD. There's like weird effects that people thought of as like really trippy. Do you want to talk at all about the, I know you weren't, this is 1967, you weren't around yet.
Yeah, but you know what, we took loads of that when we mixed it. No, we didn't. Yeah, we relived, you know.
Get
we
in
got
the spirit.
We got in the suits and we took LSD and we, you know, it was. You know what, I think there's a lot written about that. I think it just blew people's minds. I think blew sober as well as, you know, I don't think the album was designed for drugs, and it wasn't really designed on drugs either. You know, I just don't think it was. They're certainly fairly lucid in the studio when they're recording it. So I think they were experimenting with everything, and music was one of those experimentations. And I think that with the album, funny enough, I think that you take the songs in isolation, and they're not that weird. I mean, they really aren't that weird. It's just the fact they're next to each other. I think that's what makes it a great album, is the fact that you go from Within You, Without You to When I'm 64 to Lovely Rita. I mean, they're three incredibly different songs, almost by different bands. It's almost a schizophrenic record.
So we've been talking about how, you know, people who in 1967 were listening to Sgt. Pepper often thought of it as like really trippy because of all of the unusual processing and sound effects and overdubbing that was done on it. And distortions. And so you could look at it as like, wow, psychedelic, or you could see it as really borrowing heavily from the experimental music of the era. So I want to talk with you about the end of a day in the life where all of this is like very evident. So it ends with a kind of dissonant piano chord that very slowly dissolves, which we'll talk about a little later. But before that, there's this kind of weird mix of sound. And so before we hear it, I want you to explain what's happening before that piano chord.
The Day in Life is an extraordinary song. You know, it's almost, you know, it's psychedelic in its thought process. And it goes that sort of, you know, almost, it's two mindsets. It's John and Paul, whereby, you know, John had this beautiful, haunting melody. And then they had nothing to put in the middle, and Paul said, "I've got this other song," which they just, you know, stuck in the middle, and they had to join the two together. And when they recorded it, they left a big hole. They just left a hole where nothing happened at all. And it was Paul that came up to my father and said, "You know, he was, you know, being influenced by also, you know, John Cage and all sorts of people," and just said, "You know, we should do an orchestral orgasm." and my father said, "I'm sorry." I said, "We should do an orchestral orgasm. You know, this big sort of, you know, orchestral thing. It just, you know, blows your mind and explodes other speakers." And so they got a symphony orchestra. I said they were going to get a symphony orchestra. My dad, it's amazing to think at the time. He actually said, "I think, you know, we don't want to go over budget here, chaps." And so they got a 60-piece. And so Ringo said, "Well, why don't we record them twice?" And in fact, what they did is they recorded them four times. So we have a four-track tape with four orchestras on it, which we can then combine for this new mix. And it's just extraordinary. I mean, it's I can't think of another album that just has a symphony orchestra on as an effect. You know, it's like, what's a good sound here? Oh, the sound of a symphony orchestra would be a good idea. And so what you hear at the end of the song is this crescendo from a low E, which is the sustained note at the end of the verse, into a high E, which is the final climax. And then they had to think, okay, how do we finish this?
So everybody in the orchestra is sliding up an octave.
Everyone in the orchestra, my father had to tell everyone in the orchestra to unlearn everything they'd learned. The way orchestras work is they have to work as one body. You know, they are sort of, there's a brain, which you could argue is the first violinist or the conductor, and then all of the limbs of the orchestra have to work in complete and utter harmony, and, you know, to use the correct word. And my father told them, if you're playing the same note as the person next to you, you're playing the wrong note. But there's markers. I need you to reach this E at this stage, you know. And so it's a long gliss, as we call it. And that's what the orchestra played. And because it was a Beatles session, and because it was the first time they had a symphony orchestra in, the Beatles came in and they invited, I think, Marianne Faithfull and Mick Jagger, and a whole load of people were there. And it was very, you know, wreathed in marijuana smoke. And the Beatles made the orchestra wear sort of clown costumes and animal heads, and just, you know, there's the video of it. And this is what they did. It was like a happening. You know, that's what they had in those days. It was a happening in Studio One. And it's kind of an extraordinary sound. It's a sound that I don't think, it's a sound that's never really been repeated. It's like it's incredibly intense. And then they had to, once they'd come with this climax, they had to finish it with something, and they didn't actually record the piano chord for quite a while later. They knew they needed it to resolve, but they couldn't decide what to do.
So I'm going to play the new stereo remix that you've done of the end of A Day in the Life. My guest is Giles Martin, who produced the new 50th anniversary box set of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. We'll hear outtakes from the ending of A Day in the Life and hear more of the story behind it after a break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Giles Martin, who produced the new 50th anniversary box set of the groundbreaking Beatles album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which includes the original mono mix and Giles Martin's new stereo remix. The box also includes many outtakes from the session. Giles is the son of George Martin, who produced the original Sgt. Pepper album. When we left off, we were listening to the new stereo remix of the track A Day in the Life. The end was intended to sound like an orchestral orgasm and finishes with a crashing, sustained piano chord that very slowly decays. Now, the new 50th anniversary box set also has rehearsal sessions of what went on to create that chord at the end. So would you describe the piano chord that ends the track, and how many pianos are there?
Well, they needed a big ending, and the piano chord was the way to go forward. And what they did is Paul and John and Mal Evans, their roadie, played three pianos. But they played three pianos, I think, three times. So it's a four-track tape. And then they played a pianos and a sort of very distorted low-end sort of Wurlitzer, an electric organ, on the fourth track to create this massive sort of sustain. And it's very tricky. You have to... Because they wanted the longest piano chord ever, what they would do is every time they recorded it, they would turn up the mic pre, as it were, the input gain. So the piano chord, as it died away, they'd make it louder in the studios. And that's what it is. They wanted the biggest chord ever, and they kind of got it.
Okay, so what's really great is on the 50th anniversary album of Sgt. Pepper, you have like a rehearsal track. I assume it's a rehearsal track. That's like an outtake of this, and we hear them putting together the piano chord. So
yeah, no, this isn't the rehearsal track. Actually, this is what they actually use. This is them using it. Yeah, this is how they're just trying to go for it. You know, you can hear them talking to each other, and this is once they decide to do it. This is the process of them recording it.
Okay, so here's that.
1, 2, 3.
Six.
All right, don't sort of just play it quite quiet, and you know you'll know where the four comes in. Then. Mm. 1, 2, 3.
Okay, so
once again, still not quite together.
Seven.
All
right. 1, 2, 3.
Take 8.
Okay.
Take 9.
That's it. Yeah.
Off and on.
That, yeah.
Off.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3.
So that's like the raw material of the end. of A Day in the Life. Now, there's another track that is an outtake of this, and it's kind of the Beatles doing a vocal harmony version of an ending chord that isn't nearly as dramatic. So explain what's going on with this, and then we'll hear it.
Well, the reassuring thing about the Beatles is even they had bad ideas. And even making this album, they had bad ideas. I think that, you know, for anyone aspiring to be an artist out there, never be scared of a bad idea. Just be scared of sticking with it, I think, is the answer. And so their original idea, before the piano, the original idea was to create a sort of a sort of choir hum at the end. And I think, I don't know who's in the studios with them. You can hear other people chatting and they're giving directions. But this is their original plan for the end of A Day in Life and the end of the most famous album of all time.
So let's hear it.
All right. Ready now, you're not doing well.
Check the notes. Stop freaking out, missus. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay.
That's all right. Check 10.
It will be. Quiet. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay, so that's an outtake. That's on the new 50th anniversary edition of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. So why did they reject this?
I just think it doesn't, you know, I think your listeners can tell it doesn't have much impact. You know, they needed a big ending, and that wasn't it. And in fact, you can hear at the very end of that, I put the four track. They recorded on four tracks. They did it properly. I mean, the thing about the Beatles, they'd stick to their guns, and they wouldn't give up on an idea. And they finished it, and then they realized that it just didn't work.
Interesting. It's great to be led into the process.
Well, I think it is. I think the beauty of listening to the process is that you realize that, you know, there's a lot of talk about this album being, you know, this sort of albums, you know, delivered by unicorns and sent from the gods and plucked from the skies and you know, delivered by a drug haze. But really, the beauty of it is it's just four human beings making noise in the studios. They just happen to make a very good noise with very good songs.
So I want to talk to you about one of my favorite things on this box set, and there's so many tracks on it, it's hard to choose, but there's just like a, what can I call it, an acoustic take of Strawberry Fields, and the final version of it has a lot of, like, there's processing on John Lennon's voice, there's, you know, a lot of, you know, added instruments on it, and this is just like very stripped down, there's no processing on his voice. And whereas the actual release version sounds kind of like psychedelic trippy, the original version sounds very just kind of wistful and alienated.
Well, it's kind of sweet, the original version. And I think that's a lot to do with the process of, you know, John, my father always just said, you know, John never liked the sound of his own voice. That's the thing, is, you know, and to demand them to make changes. And, you know, he was just a natural, beautiful singer.
So hear that on this.
The other thing about the original Strawberry Fields is, of course, they had to slow it down. And that gives you a more of a sort of a demonic edge, you know, your slowed down voice. And so what you hear is John slowed down. In fact, on this album, there's very few occurrences of a natural voice. They played around with tempos, you know, on When I'm 64, Paul's voice is sped up, you know, and same with Lovely Rita. You know, Penny Lane, his voice is sped up, and on Strawberry Fields, John's is slowed down. It's they're all over the shop just trying to change things. But you're right, on the demo or on the first take of Strawberry Fields, you hear the song for what it is, which is an incredibly complex but beautiful personal sort of diary to his time in Liverpool.
What was Strawberry Fields? I mean, it was an actual place, right?
Yeah, Strawberry Fields is still there. It's a park in Liverpool near John's home.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, you know, I think that the funny thing about them is that very few bands are as identified by their place as much as the Beatles are. You know, I don't know whether it's because they are not as successful, but I think it's more the fact that the Beatles never really, they took Liverpool with them wherever they went. They were very proud of where they were from, and they still are. And this was despite the turmoil of going around the world and, you know, picking up influence from everywhere. You know, the way that they were going to root themselves in this new sort of psychedelic, as you say, album was to start with their home place, which was Strawberry Fields, and then Paul counts it with Penny Lane. And you can kind of hear this very early take. You can hear that it's, you know, my dad always said he always remembers the day that John came in, and John sat on a stool and played him the song on the studio floor. And that was always one of his favorite memories.
Okay, so let's hear the original track of Strawberry Fields without any processing or speeding up or slowing down, without extra instruments. Here's John Lennon singing.
Living is easy with eyes closed, misunderstanding all you see. It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. No one I think is in my tree. I mean, it must be high or low. That is, you can't, you know, tune in, but it's all right. That is, I think it's not too bad. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about.
fairy fields forever. Always know sometimes.
So that's a track from the new 50th anniversary box set of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And that's a version of Strawberry Fields without processing, without extra instruments. And my guest is Giles Martin, who oversaw the production of this new box set. And his father was the producer on the original album, Sgt. Pepper's. So, you know, I hear that and I wonder, like, what exactly was it that John Lennon didn't like about his voice? His voice is just so sweet and so, I don't know, kind of captivating. Do you know why he didn't like his own voice?
Well, I don't think it was just his voice. He didn't like, you know, my father always told me that the sounds that John had in his head were never the sounds that they got on record. And after the Beatles split up, you know, they all, it was like a smashing some of the toffee hammer. They all clustered in different sections of the corners of the world. And John did a few interviews and he sort of criticized my father. When it came to, you know, Let It Be, he said, you know, I don't want any of your production, a rude word, on this album. You know, I don't want you ruining it with your production. And my dad was sort of deeply offended because he was actually very close to John to begin with. And there was, everyone changed. And he went back. He hadn't spoken to John in a long time. And he went back. John phoned him up and he went to go and see him at the Dakota Building in New York, which is where John lived in 1980, just a month before he died, I think. And my dad said, listen, John, you said some terrible things about me. And he goes, hey, George, I was high. Which my father sort of like, you know, being my father sort of didn't really accept that as an excuse. But then he said, you know, do you know what I'd like to do, George? He goes, I'd like to go and record everything again. And my dad went, really? He goes, what about Strawberry Fields? He goes, oh, especially Strawberry Fields. And he never really was content with it, with, you know, not the sound of his voice, but never really thought, you know, what was in his head. And I think this is what, you know, this is why they push so hard for, you know, sonic, you know, perfection or interesting sounds, is because their goals were so high. And so with his voice, he had, you know, he was one of the best singers in the world, but it was never good enough. And so he always wanted something else. He wanted some sort of change done to his voice.
I want to play one of the, I don't know what to call, if this is an outtake or just like the track that was layered over, but this is Good Morning. You really get to hear them as a band without other instruments on this because it's a kind of naked track. Ringo's drumming is really so good on this. It really showcases his drumming.
Ringo's a great drummer. If I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago and, you know, we talked about this and he just said, you know, I love this because you can hear, you know, people can hear me at my drums. And he said, it's not as though I turn the drums up, it's just that we don't have to be so careful nowadays of the needle jumping out of the groove or breaking someone's speakers 50 years ago. We can be more courageous with dynamics. But yeah, he was an amazing, you know, every amazing band has to have a great drummer. And this particular track's interesting because it's actually Ringo and Paul playing drums together. You know, the hit sort of kick drum you can hear, the sort of flappy kick drum sound is Paul hitting a kick drum.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And that's what
you
can hear on this. Yeah, so that's what the take is. This is actually the take that was used, and it's just them playing, playing live and recording it before they did. You know, they overdubbed the brass, the saxes, and bass, I think. So and backing vocals, then the animal sounds at the end. I mean, the funny thing about the animal sounds on Good Morning is John demanded that each animal could eat the next animal in line. That was his that was his request. So this is, and I think this is true for the whole album. This just shows you that it's you have to start off with raw emotion, you know, as a starting point for something that touches you, and then you can embellish it with other artful and interesting colors, but it's the raw impact that is always, that you always go back to as a listener.
So let's hear that kind of naked version of Good Morning before all the other things were layered on top of it. This is from the 50th anniversary box set edition of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Somebody needs to know the time, glad that I'm here. Watching the skirt, you start to flirt, now you're in gear. To a show, you hope she goes. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay. Mm-hmm.
So that's from the 50th anniversary edition of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And my guest is the producer who oversaw this project, Giles Martin. And he is the son of George Martin, who produced the original album back in 1967. So we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with Giles Martin, who produced the new 50th anniversary box set of the Beatles album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. His father, George Martin, produced the original 1967 album. The new box includes outtakes and Giles' new stereo remix of the album. So how closely did you work with Paul and Ringo on this 50th anniversary project?
Well, you know, once we decided we were going to do it, and I felt it was a strange time because when we initiated this, we were all speaking anyway, because actually my father was very sick and he sadly passed away last year in March. And I knew I was going to do this project. And I came back to the studios and the first voice I heard was his. You know, Yoko actually said to me when we were doing Love that John, you know, she goes, it's funny, John's just a voice now. And that kind of touched me a little bit with my hearing my father in the studios. And so we talked about what we were going to do. I answer to them, obviously, it's their record, it's their music. And it's very humbling that they have so much confidence in me, you know, with what I've done, and they like what I do. So really in the studios, what happens is, I go off and I have a great engineer called Sam O'Kell, and we work together. I think about for a while our approach, and then we do it. And then I'll go and sit with Paul or Ringo and play it to them. It's as simple as that. And it really is. It's just a sort of very, very small unit. And we try and do the best we can. And you know, if they're not happy, then no one gets to hear it. I have this sort of eiderdown, this blanket around me, which is them, where they encourage me to push boundaries and go crazy because they can always say no. And that's kind of reassuring in a funny way.
Mm. You know, you have distance on the album in the sense that people who grew up with that album tended to play it like over and over and over and to be listening to, what's the secret message in this track? What are they doing with the calliope? Like, how do they make that chord? And you get so used to hearing it as it was originally done that the thought of hearing it differently is, originally very off-putting in some ways to a lot of people because, like, no, this is how it's supposed to be, the way I heard it. And you have distance on that. Like, you didn't grow up hearing it over and over again. You didn't grow up with it. So you can just hear it as music and, you know, make decisions about how to improve the mix or, like, you know, historically what's most interesting.
With something like this, I had the advantage of not, you know, I could, and this again, upsetting people, I couldn't have probably named you the running order of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band before I started working on it, because I almost distanced myself deliberately so I can approach it in a new way. And then I also listened to other people as well. I listened to, you know, the real fans, and there's some experts I know, and I invite them into the studios and see whether they're going to firebomb my house after they listen to it, you know. And also this professor, there's a guy called Bob Clearmountain, who's a very famous mix engineer, who's a good friend of mine. And a while back, I went to his studios. I was in L.A., and I played him some of the mixes. And he goes, you know, Mike, I feel like I've taken weed and listened to the album for the first time. And he was crying. And I suddenly realized, okay, well, you know, this is I'm going in the right direction. Here's someone who's mixed, you know, David Bowie and Roxy Music and Bruce Springsteen. And he's impressed. So you have to be careful. At the same time, my job with them and what they want me to do is try and push boundaries in the same way that they did. And that's my responsibility. And you sort of have to take that and run with it.
So a question about your father. My understanding is you started working in the recording studio when your father started losing his hearing and he wanted you to help him. How much hearing loss did he have? And as somebody who worked in sound all of his life, what was it like for him when he started losing his hearing?
Well, his sound loss was gradual but consistent. You know, he was pretty profoundly deaf when he died. And for him, I think it was more the loss of conversation, the loss of not being able to hear his grandchildren, mm-hmm. more than music. He'd heard enough music in his life. He used to say, if you turn me upside down, notes will fall out. But he, you know, I think in a funny way, you know, he never. I was good at music. I know I say that's so arrogant. I was sort of kind of okay at music as a kid. I was kind of a little bit better than my friends at school, maybe not Mozart, but I wasn't bad. He could tell. I started busking on the streets of London when I was 15. He could tell I had music in me and I had the bug. And he was like, you know, you're not going to do music. There's no way you're going to do music. And then he started losing his hearing. He thought, oh, you know, what do I have? I've got this precocious son that could be my ears. And that's the way we worked together. I mean, from quite a young age, I was in studios with him listening. And we had a sort of a strange, he thought we were telepathic. Before he died, he thought we were telepathic, which I'm not sure we were, but we did have a complete understanding of each other, and I knew what he wanted to hear. It was tough for my dad because he was so good, you know, certainly better than I was. And yet his one thing he had that was great, he started losing. But what he lost more than anything else, because my father was incredibly intelligent. You know, you spoke to him. He was very witty. He was charming. And people thought, if you go deaf, people think you're dumb. You know, people think you're right. Not engaging, you know, right. And I think that more than anything else, he'd made great music. It was just, he missed out on conversation.
Did your father teach you how to listen or what to listen for?
Yeah, I think he didn't sit down and say, now listen, Giles, this is what you should be listening for. But he would explain frequencies to me in the same way he did with the Beatles. He was fascinated by the colours of sound. You know, we do listen to it, sound and colours. I mean, I think people are surprised. People I work with, actually, engineers are surprised that I can go, you know, we need to remove like 2 dB at 450 hertz, or, you know, it's, you know, that you can hear frequencies. I suppose that's a speciality. That he would teach me. But I think that I learned how to listen because I knew what frequencies he couldn't hear and I'd have to fill in. And then it became more and more. And so it was like a gradual imbibing process. Listen, I don't know. I think the other is you have to question what you do all the time. I do this and, you know, I have to make the final decision, but I could always be wrong. And you just hope to God you're right, because you're not quite sure. You know, it's a bit like choosing colours, really. You hope you've chosen the right colour, and you're seeing it the same way the rest of the world sees it.
Giles Martin, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much, and congratulations on the anniversary box set.
Terry, thank you so much for having me. I'm honoured to be on the show. Thank you very much.
Giles Martin produced the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band 50th Anniversary Box Set. When I spoke with him in June, he was in the Abbey Road Studios in London. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Rick Wartzman, author of the new book, The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. It's about the erosion of the social contract between employer and employee. We'll also hear from Sharon Horgan, co-creator and star of the Amazon comedy series Catastrophe. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zadie, and Thea Chaloner. Teresa Madden directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
What would you think if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. And I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends. What do I do?